Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, nearly one in five children in New York were food insecure in 2022. That's up significantly from the previous year, and research shows that students underperform when they're hungry. During her State of the State speech last month, Governor Kathy Hochul proposed a free school to breakfast and lunch proposal for New York State's 2.7 million students. It could impact the season's budget negotiations. We'll find out from New York Focus about what's at stake, how the proposal could impact students, and what challenges remain. SNAP Ed Fruit and Vegetable Prescription Program has partnered with the Ellenville community to support nutrition and wellness. We'll learn more. Plus, Terry Thaw, Bob Dylan's first manager, will talk to her. Plus, Farm Arts Collective's winter workshops, all coming up. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is suggesting that the United States take over Gaza and redevelopment as displaced Palestinians are relocated to other countries. Trump also said he envisioned Palestinians and others returning to the region once it's rebuilt. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports Palestinians are reacting to the idea.
29-year-old Bassam Muhammad Abdelrauf stands in the central square of Gaza City, once grand and now reduced to piles of rubble, after more than a year of war between Israel and Hamas. Still, he says he would never leave. Even if there was a place that was a million times better, I would still live among the rubble and the tents, he says. It's hard to describe my love for Gaza, my home, he adds. But for some, life in Gaza has simply become too hard. 30-year-old Yahya Barakat says he would leave if given the chance. My home is gone, my life is gone, my future is gone, he says. If I find a country that embraces me, provides me with safety, I'll go. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv, with reporting from NPR's Anas Baba in Gaza City.
More than 2 million federal workers are facing a deadline on Thursday to accept a deferred resignation offer. Some Democratic lawmakers are slamming the offer as illegal or a scam. Randy Irwin is the president of the National Federation of Federal Employees, which represents some U.S. government workers.
The kind of things that they have said they wanted, some 75% reduction in the federal workforce, cutting $2 trillion from the federal budget. Those things are absolutely irresponsible. Impossible.
The deferred resignation offer is seen as a step toward removing many of the 2.3 million government employees in a White House effort to overhaul federal agencies. Stocks on Wall Street open lower this morning as the U.S. Postal Service backtracks on plans to block small package shipments from China. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow fell about 82 points in early trading.
The Postal Service says it will continue to deliver packages from China to addresses in the United States, lifting a hold that was imposed a day earlier. The goods in those packages may cost more, however. The Trump administration ordered a new 10% tariff on imports from China this week and says it will no longer exempt small dollar deliveries to individual customers, a loophole that had been exploited by some e-commerce companies in China. The Postal Service says it's working with customs officials on a way to collect those import taxes. Talks on a possible merger between Honda and Nissan appear to be stalled. The two Japanese automakers say they're exploring their options. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Earthquakes are continuing to shake the Greek island of Santorini. Authorities are stepping up their emergency plans in the event that the tremors lead to a larger quake in the coming days. Coast Guard vessels and a military landing craft have been dispatched in a wider region in the event that evacuations are ordered. Police in Sweden say 10 people were killed and at least five others were injured in a shooting on Tuesday. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports a gunman opened fire at an education center in the central part of the country.
Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson described the attack at an adult education center in the city of Örebro as the worst mass shooting in Swedish history. Police say the suspect is also dead and is believed to have acted alone. Police have warned the death toll could continue to rise as several people had been shot. The shooting occurred at a school for adult education, which is located on a campus where other schools, including those for children, are based. Scandinavian authorities have worked to crack down on gun violence over recent years, following an uptick in deadly gang-related shootings. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Copenhagen.
Nearly 50 million Americans from the Midwest to the Northeast could be in the path of a severe winter storm starting later tonight. Forecasters say the weather system is expected to bring ice and freezing rain that could make travel conditions dangerous in many regions. Stocks on Wall Street are continuing to trade lower at this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 161 points, the Nasdaq down 132. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting I'm Still Here, a film by Walter Salles starring Fernanda Torres. A woman is forced to reinvent herself after her family suffers an injustice by the Brazilian government, now playing select cities.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll hear about Governor Kathy Hochul's universal free school breakfast and lunch program proposal in a few minutes. But first, interests on both sides of the U.S.-Canada border remain guarded despite the 30-day pause on tariff threats President Donald Trump agreed to Monday for Canada and Mexico. The pauses provide a cool-down period after a tumultuous few days that put North America on the cusp of a trade war. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's North Country Bureau Chief Pat Bradley reports from Albany.
President Trump announced that 25% tariffs on imported goods from Mexico and Canada that were set to go into effect on Monday would be postponed until March. North Country Chamber of Commerce President Gary Douglas told attendees at an event Tuesday that despite the brief reprieve, lasting damage to cross-border trade has been done.
In 2017, there was a negative reaction to some of the limited tariffs that were applied from the White House at that time, and we started to see a little bit of backlash. We got through it. We came back without a lot of damage being done. This time, I think we are already deep into damage. We're going to have to work very hard to try to start to undo the damage and hopefully make it limited. No matter where we go in the tariff matter now, there's been some real damage.
Douglas says the 30-day delay is welcome, but the thought of potential tariffs that linger continues to have a negative impact on cross-border trade and business.
That 30 days hangs over us. And that, in and of itself, while better than going forward with the tariffs, is still having a deleterious effect on business decisions because it keeps a cloud of uncertainty over the economy. So the sooner we get to where we get out of this situation, the better.
Town of Plattsburgh Supervisor Michael Cashman is cautiously optimistic about the 30-day pause, but says nearby communities must remain vigilant.
We're talking about the impact to grocers. We're talking about the impact to our farmers with getting key materials. We're talking about our manufacturing businesses being able to get supplies, provide supplies, keeping workers on the line because there could be work stoppages if they can't get materials. I mean, it is very, very impactful. And I know many of the individuals in the manufacturing realm are trying to source other opportunities to make sure that they can keep business moving as normal as possible. 30 days is not a long time. So there is still a lot of anxiety built into this period of time. There's a huge sigh of relief, but we can't sit on our laurels either.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat, met privately with Canadian Consul General Tom Clark on Tuesday to discuss the potential ramifications of federal tariffs. In brief remarks released by the governor's office, Clark says the relationship between Canada and New York goes beyond trade.
As far as Canada is concerned, the relationship with New York State is one of our most important relationships anywhere in the world. You're the 10th largest economy in the world. And when we take a look at $50 billion in two-way trade every year, that number says it all. But I think, as you've said more than once, it's not the numbers that describe the relationship. It's the centuries that we have worked together, lived together, and cooperated together.
Quebec's Delegate General in New York, David Brulotte, says the economic implications of tariffs for trade between Quebec and New York State are unknown.
I can only speak for the province of Quebec, but, you know, Canada said openly as well that There's a list of tariffs that could be imposed from Canada. And as our premier from Quebec mentioned on several occasions, nothing is off the table. But we'll make sure that we're ready to protect Quebec's economy, the citizens of Quebec. And lastly, to your point about New York, I think our relationship with the state is strong. Our companies, both south and north of the border, have vested interest across the frontier, across the border. So I think through our communities, our companies, you know, we'll find ways to go through those eventual tariffs.
On Tuesday, Vermont Governor Phil Scott formed a multi-agency support team on potential tariffs to assess possible impacts on the state, identify options to mitigate short and long-term effects, and opportunities for any potential upside to tariffs. I'm Pat Bradley, WAMC News.
And also from the New York Public News Network, reporting on Tom Clark's comments, that's the Canadian Council General. He was in Albany meeting with state lawmakers and warning that the Trump tariffs, if they do go into effect next month, would hit New Yorkers' energy costs first. You can read more about his comments and how it might impact the costs for your fossil fuel and green energy at our website, WJFFradio.org. Now, the governor, Kathy Hochul, is proposing a major shift in how New York State supports students, a universal free school breakfast and lunch program. If passed, it would ensure that all 2.7 million students in the state have access to meals at no cost to their families. With nearly one in five children experiencing food insecurity in 2022, the most recent numbers we have, advocates argue that this initiative could not only reduce financial burdens on families, but also improve student performance in the classroom. But the proposal faces budget negotiations and political hurdles. Radio Catskills' Jason Dole spoke with Bianca Fortis from New York Focus. They've been covering the story closely, and Bianca helps us break down what's at stake, how this could impact students, and what challenges remain.
So Governor Hochul is proposing a universal school meal program for the following school year. So for the 25-26 year, that's expected to cost about $340 million. So actually right now, about 90% of students in New York actually do already have their meals covered thanks to the legislature. But there is a gap. There are some kids who don't have their meals covered. And so this program, the state universal program, would effectively close that gap and make sure that all students have access to breakfast and lunch while they're in school. The really great thing about a universal meal program is that it helps reduce the stigma for kids who might be embarrassed that they qualify for free lunch. And so experts generally agree that this is a great move.
Maybe let's talk about, you know, the benefits of a free lunch for, you know, those students who really need it, you know, who otherwise couldn't afford it, because food insecurity is a growing concern for everyone. And that includes, you know, young people and students. What impact does hunger have on student performance and well-being?
Well, we know that for many kids, especially those who live in poverty, school meals may actually be the only meal they get in a day. And research does show that children perform worse in school when they're hungry. And so providing meals in schools is not only an opportunity to meet the needs of a very vulnerable population, but it can also help kids do better academically. And that's really what we want for our students.
And I guess it follows from there, and this is my speculation, this is not journalism, but it's my speculation that if students perform better at school, then maybe, just maybe, our society will perform a little bit better, whether that's in terms of its economy or in terms of the civic good we can accomplish by working together with fully fueled brains, both when, you know, fueled in the morning when you have breakfast, but fueled when you spent your childhood having breakfast and being able to retain knowledge and information. It can only benefit everyone. That said, the reason that we're talking to you about this is because, of course, Governor Hochul's rolled out these proposals now because this is the kickoff of the budget process in New York State. And I keep reminding listeners this because this is a big revelation to me. A couple of years ago, as I started paying more attention to state politics, the budget process in New York is where a lot of policy gets determined. It's where a chunk of the legislative action of the year is determined in the budget process. So that said, this proposal has a significant price tag. So what are the funding challenges and how are lawmakers responding to this proposal and this cost? Because ultimately they're going to weigh in on this too.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we will have to see what happens during budget negotiations. I do think that because there is support among legislators, there are a couple of legislators who have actually been pushing for this for years. And since we are already covering up, since we are already covering most students, I think that this proposal probably does have a good chance of passing. I actually was in the joint legislative budget hearing yesterday on education, and there was some talk of this program, and people generally seemed supportive of providing school meals. And actually, there are a few cities, larger urban cities, including New York City, that already do this. So I think this does have a good chance of making it through the budget negotiations.
Okay, you know, and we've been talking about school meals and the impact on education, but Governor Hochul also has proposals to impact education. Proposals include free community college, at least for certain fields, and also smartphone restrictions in schools. These are both stories that we're following here. Can you talk about how these proposals fit into the broader education policy landscape in the state?
Absolutely. So when it comes to the community college proposal, that proposal does affect specific fields, but that includes teaching. And so teaching is one area where we're seeing significant labor shortages across the state. So this is an opportunity that could help build back up that workforce. And with cell phones, we are hearing a lot from educators that kids are really distracted in schools because of their phones. They're not paying attention in class. And so what Hochul is proposing, and she's been talking about this for some time now, is it would be a statewide bell-to-bell policy where kids are not allowed to use their phones during the day. And so that would be up to individual districts to decide how they want to implement that ban. There is some funding from the state to help support that. But, you know, the goal is really just to help kids do better in school.
Before we go, because you do cover, you know, education for New York State Focus, I was wondering, is there anything else that you're looking at right now in terms of education in the state that we should know about?
Absolutely. I think the number one issue is actually foundation aid. This is probably the thorniest issue. So this is the formula that the state uses to decide how much school aid districts will get each year. And the formula is very out of date. Everybody generally agrees that it needs an overhaul. And so last year, the governor commissioned the Rockefeller Institute to study the formula and make recommendations for how to improve it. And so they did. In December, they published this very thorough report that had a long list of suggestions. And so she's taking two of those suggestions now that would update what's called the Pupil Needs Index. And so we're looking at updating poverty data that's used in the formula, which is really important because the current formula uses data from the 2000 U.S. Census. You can imagine how outdated that is. And then we're also looking at replacing the free and reduced price lunch metric, which is no longer accurate, especially now as we're moving toward universal meals. And so the sense I've gotten generally is that people think these are good and necessary changes, but a lot of education leaders are asking for more. They're asking the legislature to follow more of the Rockefeller Institute's suggestions and make more changes to the formula. And so now we're just going to have to wait and see what happens during the negotiations.
Right. And that's the period that we'll continue to cover this. We'll continue to check in with everyone at New York State Focus, because it's going to be the same thing with all other areas of policy in New York State. We got to watch and see what shakes out of the budget negotiation process. But for now, I will say we've been talking to Bianca Fortis, education reporter at New York Focus. Her latest work is up now at nysfocus.com. Bianca, thank you so much for breaking this all down for us.
Happy to chat. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Jason Dole and Bianca Fortis from New York Focus for that as well. There's more of New York Focus's reporting at their website, nysfocus.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn more about the SNAP Ed Fruit and Vegetable Program in Ellenville. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, John Mills, co-founder of WatchDuty, an app that provides users with up-to-the-minute information on wildfires. Then we pay tribute to the late Cecile Richards, former president of Planned Parenthood, with a 2018 conversation from our archives. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Last year, Ellenville Regional Hospital's boardroom became a hub for community engagement, learning, and a little laughter. Local residents and patients from the Ellenville-Wawarsing area participated in 10 sessions of SnapEd New York's fruit and vegetable prescription program, supported by the hospital's nutritionist, to help them achieve their personal nutrition goals. Nutrition educator Mary Brimmer and Megan Young, SnapEd nutritionist with the SnapEd New York Hudson Valley team based out of the Cornell Cooperative Extension, Orange County, are joining us this morning to tell us more about that and the new program that's coming up for 2025. Good morning.
Good morning.
Could one of you tell us a little bit about the goals of SnapEd New York's fruit and vegetable prescription program and how you guys partnered with Ellenville Regional?
Sure. So our goals of our fruit and vegetable prescription program, there are a couple of them. One, we want to help increase consumption of fruits and vegetables and increase access to them while also kind of closing that loop of like disconnect that can happen between provider and patient. So we're looking to create a systems change here. You know, sometimes you go to the doctor and they might, you know, if you have high blood pressure and they say, you know, you should eat less salt, and you're like, okay, but if they don't understand kind of what's happening or have further conversations with you or that patient about what's happening behind the scenes, you know, maybe you're struggling to your budget's tight, right? Food is expensive right now. Or like, how do I even go about reducing salt? What do you mean? So, you know, closing that loop of disconnect and having a better understanding between those provider and patient conversations is important to us too through this program. And so through that, we've connected with local healthcare partners, and that being Ellenville Regional Hospital, the Rural Health Network. And they were more than willing. They're very involved in their community, and they really loved, you know, the concept of our program. And so they were an easy sign-on. We didn't have to do too much arm twisting to get them to work with us on this. It was really kind of just, it just happened. They said, absolutely, we're interested. And so our program really focuses on the providers screening, having those conversations with their patients about, you know, are they struggling to kind of make ends meet, to provide food? You know, they screen for food insecurity, and then they can make referrals to our program.
You, we talk about nutrition and education, and sometimes it can feel a little dry. Something you guys that was innovative, I think, was this grocery store tour. And it seemed like a great hands-on way to apply these lessons. Talk a little bit about the grocery store tour at the local market there and how that helped participants put their knowledge into practice.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was the educator for this cohort. This was my first time doing it in person with everyone. So during the lessons, we really talk through what we call the three Ps of planning, purchasing, and preparation. I also like to add in there that preservation is an important step to that as well, to make the most of the produce items that they're getting. So the grocery store tour was the very last class. So it was really a culmination of everything that we discussed in our classes and a way for us to kind of check in with what people have retained from the classes that we had together. And we'd start out, we'd look at the sales flyer, we'd talk about any
kind of grocery store lists or meal planning that people do before they even get to the grocery store. And then we went through each section of the store. Oftentimes people talk about how you should only shop on the perimeter of the store, but actually there's nutritious items located within every section of the store. So we talked about unit prices or compared items, and people were able to share stories about what brands they prefer, what they're using, what's on sale that week, because this is the site that they were using their vouchers at as well.
What were some of the most memorable moments or successes in your view from these sessions, particularly in terms of how the participants engaged with each other and the material? And I know that one participant shared how the program, she liked to talk about that program with her daughter and enjoyed making the recipes. Talk a little bit about the sharing and passing of the knowledge and the engagement.
You know, I got to say, I'm not from the Ellenville community, but this group really felt like community. Like we all already knew each other right from the beginning. We had a lot of great personalities, and people were able to share their experiences around food and nutrition, because we all come with those, whether it's we have a lot of experience with it or not a lot of experience. During those classes, we also had the opportunity to try new recipes. So one memorable moment for me was when one of the participants who had never tried avocado got to try it in a recipe that I brought in. And so we were all there to support her, and turns out that she loves it. So this was a good opportunity for testing out some new things, sharing information, and gathering.
How do you see these programs like this contributing to the long-term well-being of just not only this community, but, you know, all of the communities that you serve?
So we really hope, again, it goes back to that systems change we're really hoping for. We hope that beyond our work, these systems changes will expand and last. We hope that our work can encourage healthcare providers to become more comfortable having conversations with their patients, kind of what we call social determinants of health. You know, what's going on beyond just kind of the health in their lives? You know, are they struggling to put, you know, food on the table? What resources are available that can help, that providers can provide to their patients? You know, we hope beyond us that we can encourage those communications, better communication between healthcare providers and patients. And beyond the vouchers that our fruit and vegetable prescription program provides, we hope that providers in the community also continue those conversations, continue to educate themselves about the social determinants of health, and knowing what resources are available in their communities, and also how more about our food systems. A really great thing about our program is really supporting local food retailers and farmers by our participants redeeming their vouchers at those local retailers, food retailers and farm stands or farmers. And that's really important for those communities as well. So ultimately, we hope this work can continue. Should we not be able to do this project in the future, we hope we've created lasting systems changes to make our communities stronger and more resilient.
Yeah, and in the previous segment, we were talking about Governor Hochul's universal school breakfast and lunch program that she proposed. And one of the statistics that stuck out to me was that nearly 1 in 5 children in New York were food insecure. That's as of the 2022 statistics, the most recent we have. And so SNAP Ed New York is really not only teaching people how to shop for healthy meals, but like that pathway to food security.
Yeah, we're hoping, you know, our work really wanting to encourage and help people make those behavior changes that will make eating healthier, shopping on a limited budget easier. Those behavior changes, you know, is what we're hoping for.
And so there's a new cohort for the SNAP Ed New York's fruit and vegetable prescription program coming up. What can folks do if they're interested in joining the program? What steps should they take to determine eligibility, and how can they get involved?
Yeah, so they should reach out to the hospital's new nutritionist. She She's part of the Ellenville Regional Rural Health Network. Her name is Courtney Jolly, and her email is cjolie@erhny.org, or she can be contacted by phone at 845-647-6400, extension 205. We really suggest that people reach out in order to begin the referral process, as well as connecting with a nutritionist at the hospital who can also connect them to other resources.
And is there a deadline? When does the new one start?
We're scheduled to start for tomorrow, but we do have
tomorrow. Yeah, we're getting some winter weather coming, so you might have a snow day, huh?
Yeah, so please do. Please don't let the weather interfere with any intentions of reaching out, because there will be other classes, and you are welcome to sign up. And we're happy to have any new participants coming.
All right, we've been talking to nutrition educator Mary Brimmer and Megan Young, SnapEd nutritionist with the SnapEd New York Hudson Valley team. There's more information about SNAP at snapedny.org, and more about Cornell Cooperative Extension at cceorangecounty.org. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk to Terry Thaw. She was a vital presence in the 1960s Greenwich Village folk music world, and she was also Bob Dylan's first manager. We'll talk to her and our own Folk Plus host, Angie Page, right after this. It's Radio Chatsco.
On the next Radio Lab.
Dun, 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 dun.
The story of the 26 little words that made the internet both the beautiful...
Double rainbow. Oh, my God.
Puppy attack.
And hideous...
Obscene. Yummy. Nasty Instagram post.
Doxing.
Indecent.
Fat, fat.
Revenge.
Fat. Pornographic.
Drink, bleach, and die. Place that it is today. That's on the next Radio Lab.
This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa this week on Latino USA, a one-on-one sit-down with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a.k.a. AOC. We're going to talk about how she plans on resisting Trump's policies, what she thinks of the future of the Democratic Party, and so much more. That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Terry Thaw was a vital presence in the 1960s Greenwich Village folk music world, where she played a pivotal role as Bob Dylan's first manager at just 21 years old. Thaw helped guide his early career, securing performances and promoting his work. She also managed other influential artists, including musician Dave Van Ronk, whom she later married, the Roach Sisters, Paul Jeremiah, and the Holy Modal Rounders. Terry Thaw will be speaking about her book, My Greenwich Village, Dave, Bob, and Me, upstairs at the Jeffersonville Bake Shop on Sunday at noon. The talk was arranged by our own folk music legend, Angela Page, the host of Folk Plus, on Sundays at 2 here on Radio Catskill. And they both are joining us now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being here, Angie.
Thanks, Tim.
And Terry, you know, I mentioned you were Bob Dylan's first manager, just 21 years old. Can you tell folks a little bit about how you came to manage him and what it was like working with him in the early years and all those other great luminaries on the folk music scene in Greenwich Village?
Well, I was young myself. I'm only a year or two older than Bob. And I had just started managing David. We were living together. We were married. And when Bob hit New York, we met him maybe a day after he came to New York, and thought the guy was a bloody genius. He was kind of stumbling all over the place. He wasn't a great guitarist. He wasn't a great singer. But he had some kind of strange, ineffable talent that was recognized not only by Dave and me, but by the folk singers, all the folk singers in New York. I mean, it was really very interesting. And we became very, very good friends. But he couldn't get any work, and there wasn't very much work to be had. And one day he said to me, "Will you get any gigs?" And I said, "Do you want me to manage you?" And he said, "Sure." So we worked out a sort of loose arrangement, and I became his manager. And but we really were good friends. We hung around a lot. We played penny poker a lot. Bob was young. He was smart. He was, at the time, he was a Woody Guthrie aficionado. He really wanted to sound like Woody Guthrie when he first came to New York. He was exploring the folk music spectrum. He was learning about the music. He learned incredibly fast. I think one of the most interesting things about him was the way he absorbed information. He could learn something and he could tuck it away into different pieces. He could take a part of it and say, "Okay, I'm going to use this now, and I'm going to use part of it later, and part of that I'm never going to use at all, so I'm just going to discard it."
Angie, you and Terry were deeply involved in the Greenwich Village folk music scene, Terry, in the 60s, as we talked about you later in the 80s. Can you talk a little bit about what makes that place such a unique place for musicians and artists?
I think it's the draw. It's people living in states all over the country going, "I'm going to go there." And they come, and they, like, my first husband, Jack Hardy, ran into Terry Roach in Philly, and they were both playing something. And Terry's like, and Maggie were like, you got to come to the Village. So it was like that. Tons of little stories of people all sort of arriving there, whether it's Tom Paxton and people in Terry's world, or whether it's Suzanne Vega. Although I want to say that Terry's husband, Dave Van Ronk, was in both worlds, because he really came to Speakeasy, he was on our board. He sort of straddled. He really was mayor of McDougal Street. He straddled both these times.
And Speakeasy was the Greenwich Village Music Club that hosted a lot of acts that you're mentioning here, too. You mentioned Tom Paxton, and I know, Terry, your apartment in Greenwich Village was a gathering spot for musicians like Tom and Phil Ochs and others. Can you share any other memorable moments from those gatherings at your apartment?
Well, there were, you want a specific, if you're looking for a very specific.
Anything that's PG-13, Terry.
I'm sorry?
Anything that's PG-13 for our listeners. I'm kidding.
I'm not going to give you a specific one.
Okay.
But people just came up. People rang the bell, and they came up every evening, and they mostly, actually, we didn't do a lot of picking sessions. It was mostly talking. We sat around, we got stoned, and we talked all night. We played records. There was some musical playing, especially when people started writing songs. I can remember nights when Tom Paxton would, so one night when Tom Paxton would sat and played a song, and then Phil Oakes sat and played a song, and then Bobby Dylan sat and played a song. And they went back and forth. They went back and forth for about an hour. But that was sort of infrequent. Mostly we just sat around and played music and talked. And it was, there was just a lot of people. I mean, you could come in any night, and there was Tom, and there was Phil, and there was John Wynn, and there was Harry Jackson. There was maybe Carolyn Hester, and if Joni Mitchell was in town later on, she would pop by. And a whole lot of people you probably have never heard of. Alice Dopkin, who lived in the building. Danny Kelp, who was a guitar student of David's, who was part of the Blues Project. Just Chuck Elliott might come by. There was just the host, Paul Clayton, when he was in New York, just the host of folk singers and a whole bunch of socialists, because David and I had one foot in the folk music world and another foot in the socialist world.
Right. Right. It was your politics, Terry, that brought you to the Village, and then you slid into the folk scene secondary. But Tim and listeners, I want to say that Terry is a wealth of information about this time period in the Village, and she is speaking, for those of you who listen in New York City or travel back and forth, she's at on Bleecker Street at the Bitter End with three other authors of timely books about Greenwich Village in the 60s, David Brown from Rolling Stone and his Greenwich Village book, and yours, Terry. Four authors are speaking at 6:30 at the Bitter End, and that's this Friday. And then Sunday, weather permitting, which we are watching closely, Terry will be up at the beautiful room above the bakery.
Jeffersonville Bake Shop there in Jeffersonville on Main Street.
Yes, and what a I just saw that 2 weeks ago. What a lovely room there is up there. So that will be wonderful, and you can hear Terry up close, and she will have her books. We will keep you informed here at the radio station if something happens. The problem is Terry's got to drive from where she lives in Rockland County to New York City, back there, over here. And if any of the weather isn't proving safe, we may have to postpone. But we will keep people.
We'll keep folks.
But I am so thrilled to be coming out there. I love Sullivan County. Years ago, I had a cabin in Ulster County. I wanted to move out there. It's actually what got me out of the city. I didn't get to Ulster or Sullivan. I got to Rockland, which isn't quite that far out. But I really love the area. I am thrilled at the idea of coming out and having wonderful coffee.
Yes.
And croissants in the bakery.
Yeah.
And I will have my book by Greenwich Village with me. And it's 85 miles from home, and it really is not that big a drive, but I've got my fingers crossed that it doesn't snow.
Yeah.
We're looking at maybe just some AM snow showers, but we'll keep folks posted. Terry, I wanted to ask you, you've probably heard of that Bob Dylan movie, A Complete Unknown, that's out up for 8 Academy Awards, including...
I have seen the movie twice. I have done a podcast about the movie. I'll be talking about the movie a bit on Sunday.
Yep. Any initial reactions you can share with us now?
She doesn't want to give it all away, Tim.
Okay. are you featured?
I will be talking about my butts.
I liked it, but.
On Sunday, I will be talking about my butt.
We'll look forward to that. In the meantime, I want to get back to your work with Mr. Dylan back in the 60s in real life. You recorded one of Bob Dylan's first live performances. That was at the Gaslight Cafe in 1961. Can you talk about that performance? And also, I understand you still own the original reel-to-reel tape of that performance?
I do. And it's going up for auction. It'll be auctioned off online in late February and early March by our auction. The sound is incredible. When I was managing Bob, I needed some way to acquaint out-of-town clubs with what he sounded like. I mean, I didn't have a record of him. We didn't have videotapes at that time. You didn't have the electronic stuff that you've got now. You needed a record. You needed an audio something. So I set up a gig at the Gaslight, and I went down there with an MPEX reel-to-reel tape machine, and I recorded him, and I took the tape to a studio. I had a little cassette made of it that I could take with me, and I took it to several clubs in Springfield, Massachusetts, and Cambridge and Philadelphia, and everybody said, take him away, he sounds like Woody Guthrie on a warm. And the audio tape did not result in my getting, I did get him some gigs, but not as a result of that audio tape, I don't think. But the tape sat. Eventually, somebody copped copies of it, I guess, from the studio, which I guess made a copy of it themselves, and it was bootlegged, but it was stopped. The sound was dreadful, and it was stopped. And I had the original, which I honestly forgot about. I forgot about it until a couple of years ago when Richard Grohn said to me, you really have to play it and see what it sounds like. So I took it to Steve Adabo at SoundCloud Studios, and the sound is just incredible. It is crystal clear. It is gorgeous.
Good for Steve.
And before we go, I just want to ask you both really about, you know, the folk music scene and where it was in the 60s, how it's evolved, and how younger people are discovering it. What are some things you want folks to know about the experiences that you guys have had in the folk music scene? And what do you hope that younger generations, you know, are able to do and grow it?
Well, speaking...
I think the thing that's ignored about the whole folk music scene is the music. Everybody, it was a wonderful... First of all, mostly it was a wonderful time. You see movies about it, you read books about it, and everybody makes it sound cutthroat. It was not cutthroat. It was the most supportive world I've ever seen in my life. People really went out of their way to help one another. People were kind to one another. It sounds a little goody-goody, but it wasn't. I mean, there was competition, but it was friendly competition. It was, people didn't even hate the club owners. I mean, I was a socialist, and the class struggle stopped. It did not extend to McDougal Street. But the thing that everybody ignores is music. It was wonderful music. I mean, you had music that had come out of America. You had music that came out of Appalachia, that came out of the South, that came out of New England. You had ballads. You had music that told stories. What attracted me to it was that it was music that tied together the way people worked and the way they ate, and then all those wonderful Murder Girl stories where young ladies got their heads cut off in England from the old English ballad. But there was all this great music, and there was great instrumentalists, and people forget about that piece gets ignored in the books somehow. I was really privileged to hear people like Eric Darling, like Mississippi John Hurt, like Gary Davis, who was still my god, and John Hurt, who was just this incredible, incredible blues singer, and Skip James, and Vanilla City Ramblers. There was an eclectic range of music. And as young people came to the village, they learned that music. They didn't go down south and collect it. They learned it from records, and they learned it from, some people did, but they learned it from each other. And then they reworked it, and they rewrote it, and they started to write their own music. And the music changed. But
yeah, as it should.
It's the music that brought them there.
Yeah. And 20 years later, I'm in the same buildings and streets, but we're doing the same thing. Everybody's supportive of each other. And I remember Dave saying, don't be jealous of someone else. It creates a scene and all the boats float, or however he put it. But the idea was there wasn't people attacking each other or feeling jealous. There was really just a great feeling about music. People would jump up on stage and sing somebody's song because they knew the lyrics, and they They were very supportive. Same thing 20 years later. So we can talk more about that on Sunday.
Yeah, and if you're in New York City on Friday, you can hear Terry at the Bitter End with some other authors about the Greenwich Village music scene of the 1960s. And then Sunday here at the Jeffersonville Bake Shop at noon, Terry will be speaking about her book live in person with called My Greenwich Village Day, Bob and Me. And then, of course, afterwards, listen to Angie Page on Folk Plus Sunday at 2 right here on Radio Catskill. Terry, thank you so much. And Angie, thank you guys so much. We look forward to your talk on Sunday.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll learn about the winter workshops at Farm Arts Collective. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This coming weekend, Farm Arts Winter Workshops. Oh, actually, tomorrow. Farm Arts Winter Workshop series starts tomorrow. It's open to artists and creatives. It's a drop-in and pay-what-you-can series of workshops. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Tanis Kowalczyk from Farm Arts Collective about the range of workshops on offer.
Good morning, Tanis, and welcome back to Radio Catskill.
Good morning, Val. It's really nice to be here.
Well, you always have something interesting going on. And this season, you have winter workshops for creatives every Thursday, February 6th through March 27th. Tell us more about this.
Of course. Thank you for asking. So every winter, before we start in on the creative process of building Dream on the Farm, we always like to do workshops that kind of get our creative juices flowing, get us with some professional development situations, and also asking members of our creative community to join us and or to teach us. So it's just a kind of a little wake up and come back into the studio to work on various aspects of performer training or writing. Just flexing the creative muscle. So we're calling it Winter Workshops for Creatives. And there's going to be about 6 or 7 weeks of this where we're going to have a lot of really cool workshops led by members of our collective and extended community of artists.
Now, for those of us who might not know about the Farm Arts Collective summer production, Dream on the Farm, can you briefly give us a little summary of that?
Yes, of course. Dream on the Farm is a series of performances that Farm Arts Collective committed to create. They're all original performances. And we are making one new play every year from the year 2020 to the year 2030 on the subject of climate change, climate resiliency, what can we do about this warming, the warming temperatures and the extreme weather that we're really starting to feel, especially as farmers, we're really feeling that now. And so we're setting the performance on our farm. We have a new theater barn space on our farm. So we get to, use that, welcome the audience to the performance when they first come. They check in at our box office, but then oftentimes the performance takes place all over the farm. So you're really getting a sense of the earth and the land and how we are connecting to it, how we're actually growing food on it, and the stress and threat of the changing climate. And so every year we make a new play. We invite our community to join us in the creation of it. Artists, writers, musicians, stilt walkers, dancers, you name it. I mean, anyone who likes to build things and create work can join the process. And I'm the director of it. So every year we've made a piece, and we're going to go into our 6th year already. I cannot believe.
These workshops are for members of your collective as well as for other creatives in the community that want to get involved?
Yeah, even if you don't think you're creative, you could come.
Okay.
Yeah, open to anybody.
Well, they sound like a lot of fun. For example, vocal and group song. You'll be doing that this Thursday, the 6th. And there is something wonderful about singing together.
Oh, yes. Singing together. Everyone can sing is my number one, like, rule of thumb. Everyone can sing. And even if it's not on tune, you're still singing, and it's good. It's good, and it adds to it, to the song. I mean, I really do believe this. And ultimately, once you learn a song, you can actually sing it. If you get to know that song, you can sing it. And so we're going to explore different songs. I'm not going to have sheet music. I'm just going to teach it orally. I have probably 100 songs in my head that I'm so excited to teach. Many of them in languages not English. Many of them chants, but just like songs from around the world that we can sing together and just use our voices together. And it's really freeing and it's really fun. And it makes you feel good to sing. So we're doing that this Thursday, February 6th, from 6 o'clock to 8. And then the next workshop, I'll just go through it. We're going to have Invoke Your Clown workshop with Clown Daddy on February 13th. We're going to have a songwriting workshop with our composer in residence, Doug Rogers, on February 20th. People are going to be tasked to write a song, and then they're going to come back the next Thursday, February 27th, and share their music and get feedback and get progress with their song in the second class. Then on March 6th, we're having a stage fighting workshop with Jess Barkle, who's a company member and also a teacher at SUNY Sullivan. And we're going to learn stage combat, consent intimacy work, punches, kicks, falls, and weapons, and it's going to be fun. And we're going to do playwriting the following week with Melissa Bell and Mark Dunow, who are our resident playwrights. And we'll end with a devising physical theater workshop with me, and we're going to learn how to make physical material that can become a performance or a way to tell a story. You know, it could be a solo performance or just learning how to tell a story, to speak, to move, to present. That's what we'll work on.
You are offering a very great deal to our community, and it sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's pay what you can. We now that we have our building, our farm building, our barn, we just need to be able to cover the cost of heating. So it's pay what you can, and we want to help to give the teachers an honorarium as well. So that is just going to be fun. I'll try to make a soup most times so we can have a little food afterwards. And it'll just be a really great event, you know, something to do in the winter months, get your body moving, get your blood flowing, get your imagination engaged together as a community.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to share this information with our listeners, Tanis. And the information is on your website?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on our website. It's www.farmartscollective.org. And to be found in our calendar or in our workshops page. Those are the two places on our website. You can start checking out all the things we have planned. We already have a lot of stuff planned for the season.
So I see that.
To come together. Yeah, it's really exciting.
Well, thank you again, Tanis.
Thanks. Okay, hope to see you. Come out, Val. Come out.
Oh, I will.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi for that report. That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Reminder, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. Get it in your inbox on Fridays. Just go to wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Bella DiPaolo is glad if you're happily married, but she is perfectly happy being single.
I would love to have someone who took care of my car or someone who cleaned up the dishes after dinner, but then I'd want them to leave.
From yourself to your dog to your spouse, our significant others That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Today's weather, sunny and a high of 23. There's a winter weather advisory in effect for tomorrow morning at 4 a.m. through 4 p.m. Mixed precipitation expected, up to 2 inches of snow and sleet, and up to 1/10 of an inch of ice accumulation.